welcome to Faith Unscripted, a weekly radio program pertaining to all things spiritual. Faith Unscripted is hosted by the Reverend Richard Hasselbeck, pastor of the historic Clarkstown Reformed Church, located at 107 Strawtown Road in West Nyack. Pastor invites you, your family, and friends to come worship every Sunday morning at 10:30 at the Clarkstown Reformed Church. Pastor loves to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to say hello or have a question for the pastor, please give us a call. Our phone number is 845-429-1700. That number again, 845-429-1700. Good morning, Pastor.
Good morning, Vince. How are you today?
Fine, thanks, and you, sir?
Yeah, a little cold.
Well, I will say it finally has happened. Hell has frozen over.
Well, you know, you remember Dante put at the lowest circle of hell there was ice.
Yeah,
it's not heat; it's ice.
Not surprising. So, I'll say this: today is definitely that day where you really want to take that very special someone and just come on hibernate under those blankets and just get cozy.
Yes, I did that with my dog last night, and my little Bichon Frise and I were very happy together. But
yes, sir.
The weather also did manage to burst one of my pipes.
Oh!
So when I got back to my home last night after a hard day of pastoring a church, there was about a quarter inch of water all over my kitchen floor. So one could do the backstroke in it and not touch the ground.
So was it John the Baptist time, or did you ask yourself, where is God in all of this?
It was Kevin Madigan time, because I had to call the plumber. And Kevin Madigan is the best plumber I have ever known. And he was there, and despite the fact I called him at 6:15 or so, he was there in no time. And fixing the problem and diagnosing other ills that might go on. So a pipe in my dishwasher burst.
Ugh.
And when I got into the kitchen, it was like a waterfall. The dishwasher was like a waterfall. It wasn't draining or anything. So we
accept donations of paper plates now. And
well, I will be eating more in paper plates. But you know, these things happen. So it's part of the little warp and woof of life, I guess. Did we get a call? We did not get a call. The phone rang, though. So if you have any questions, concerns, interests, please give us a call. The number again is
845-429-1700.
All right. And one of the things I'd like to start with today is Mary, the mother of Christ. Mm-hmm. Because this Sunday, if your church follows the lectionary, and many of the all Catholic churches do, and many Episcopal, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Reformed churches will also follow a similar pattern. The lectionary is a 3-year cycle of readings, so that the church, the worshiping church, is brought through a great deal of scripture in that 3-year cycle. So we hear a lot from the Old Testament or the Jewish Bible. We hear from the letters of Paul and the other New Testament writings, and we cycle through the Gospels. This year we're in the Gospel of Luke, for example. Mm-hmm. We're in the third year of the cycle. And then John is smattered in on big days. So we hear a lot from the Gospel of John, too. But this Sunday, the lectionary reading for the second Sunday after the Epiphany, is the John's Gospel story of the miracle of the miraculous transformation of water into wine at the wedding feast at Cana. And one of the important figures in this story is Mary, and I don't think she gets a whole lot of play. But here's the story, in a nutshell, if you don't remember it. Jesus and his friends, the disciples now, are Mary, his mother, have all been invited to a wedding feast. Now, you and I have all gone to wedding receptions, right? Mm-hmm. And we have seen great parties. There's dancing, there's singing, there's the wine and then champagne flows and other drinking as well. We've seen Uncle Harry get a little toasted at these things. And they go on after the wedding. Say the wedding ends at 5 o'clock, and from 6 to whenever, you have the reception. The bride comes in and in with some fanfare and her attendants, and they do their first dance and all that stuff. So we're familiar with our wedding rituals. In the time of Christ, weddings were an event that involved the entire village, and they went on for days and days and days. And if you think champagne flows at our wedding receptions, that's nothing compared to these celebrations that were filled with abundance and joy and dancing and laughter and stuff like that. And a lot of it was fueled by the wine. And it would have been a shame, it would have been a dishonor to run out of wine. And that's exactly what, as the story unfolds, has happened. The wedding couple has run out of wine. And so when the wine runs out, the party runs down. And people are going to be saying, huh, what was wrong with that party? So in that context, Mary, the mother of the Lord, goes to Jesus and says, they have no wine. She doesn't tell him to do anything. She implies it. They have no wine. What are you going to do about it? Jesus picks up on this implied request to do something about it by saying, woman, my time has not yet come. What does he mean by that? He means that the minute he starts doing signs that indicate his uniqueness, he is on the road to the cross, which is his time. Jesus says, woman, my time has not come, and she hears him, turns to the chief steward and says, do whatever he tells you. In a way, by doing that, she leaves Jesus free. She's not telling him or asking him to do anything. She's saying, here's the problem. Do whatever you need to do, or don't do whatever you need not to do to address that problem. And at that point, Jesus says, well, those 6 stone jars over there that hold 20 to 30 gallons, fill them up with water. Now, we're talking, 30 gallons, 180 gallons of wine, of water. And you take, and now draw some out and take it to the chief steward. And they do that. And the chief steward says, holy crow, this is good stuff. I mean, gee, you know, usually people serve this type of wine first, and then when folks have given, you know, when they're drunk enough, then you bring out the cheap stuff. But you saved the best for last. Wow. Wonder why you did that. And nobody except the servants who drew the wine, and the disciples perhaps, knew that Jesus had taken something ordinary and transformed it into something extraordinary, which is a sign of his messianic role, right? The wine, the abundance of wine, is a symbol of the coming of the Messiah, the abundance of God being splashed, literally, all over his beloved people. And so the party goes on, right? And John ends the story by saying, and his disciples believed. We don't know exactly what they believed, but they believed that something extraordinary had happened. But I want to back up, and I want to look at Mary's role in this. What motivated Mary? Because Mary is the in some ways the prime mover of this event. Mary is the one who says, son, they ran out of wine. She's the one who goes and asks him to do something. What is she doing, really? She is praying. Whenever you see Mary, I want you to hear not only the mother of Jesus, I want you to hear the church. Because Mary in the Gospels is the image of the church. And here she is the image of the praying church. So she turns to Jesus. She doesn't give him a solution. She doesn't say, look, they ran out of wine. There are 6 stone jars over there. Why don't you have them fill up the jars with water? And why don't you make more wine for them? I know you're very special, and you know God will do what you ask him to do. She doesn't say any of that. All she says is, son, they have no wine. Think of that as a model for prayer. A prayer where we don't say, heal my sick child, or heal my sick nation. We say, Lord, there is illness in my child. You handle it. Lord, my nation has lost its way. You handle it. You open and open the doors and provide the ways and create the miraculous interventions, because there are miraculous interventions if only we looked for them. And there are solutions that God provides for our problems if we just let him know what we need. Until we do that, God probably thinks, they seem to think they can do it on their own. I'll let them. When they need me, they'll ask. And the insight of Christianity is that we can ask. And when we ask our brother, Jesus. We ask our Father. We ask for the Spirit that lives within us. We are never farther from God than we are from the center of our own hearts, because that is the temple where God dwells. The problem is we rarely enter it ourselves, because we spend so much time avoiding the inner journey. But Mary didn't do that. Mary said, son, they have no wine. There's the problem. Now, when she does that, Jesus' response is, my time has not yet come. And he is just reminding her that the time of his faithfulness to the will of God, the time of the great redemptive moment, is not yet here. And when she asks this of him, she is setting in motion the journey that will lead to the cross. So what motivates Mary? Just human compassion. You know, we can pray like Mary prayed every day by noticing the needs of the people around us. You know, Lord, they have no food. Lord, they have no homes. Lord, they have no health. Lord, they have no insight. Lord, they waste their time on foolish pursuits. They spend their time watching television when they could be entering into a conversation with you. We're not giving God a solution. We are giving God a set of problems that we are aware of and that we believe need to be brought to the Lord's attention. He'll take care of figuring out what to do with them. He's been at it for years. But when we start the Lord's action in motion in our lives, we begin the journey to our time. And someone has said you can be a theologian in an armchair, but you can be a Christian only on the cross. So each one of us is called to our own moment of absolute self-surrender. That's what the cross is. That is Jesus, the Son of God, who is fully human, just like us, but also bears fully the presence, the image, and the power of God. And on the cross, we see that God's power is self-gift, and his power is love, and his power is compassion. It's not the same thing as the power that we think of as powerful. You know, Jesus, before Pilate, said, you know, if I was a king in this world, my armies would be here. You wouldn't be able to sit there in judgment of me. The tables would be turned. But Jesus is saying to him, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not even like the kingdoms of this world. I'm not a competitor of Caesar's. I'm a king of a different kind. But before me, Caesar must bend. And as we bring our needs before God in prayer, as Mary did here in Cana, we begin the unleashing the power of God within our hearts and within our lives that will ultimately lead to our moment when we are challenged to take up our cross and give of ourselves so fully that there's nothing left. That's what Christianity is all about. And we have, over the course of a couple of thousand years, we've tamed it and we've made it very, very, very simple and easy. You know, come to church, pray your rosary beads if you're a Catholic, or do your devotions if you're a Protestant. Worship for an hour and a bit every Sunday, and go about your life. Do what you do. And that's not what Jesus has envisioned as his way. What Jesus calls us to do is to be his people, God's images, in our world. And that means we can't embrace in any way the values of this world. You turn on the television, you tune into, I don't know, Yellowstone, and you see Dallas on steroids, if you're old enough to remember the TV show Dallas, mm-hmm. where it's all power and greed and position and jockeying for advantage. There's violence.
Backstabbing.
Oh, yeah. It's all the whole panoply of sin that you see in this world. And it's all made to look pretty normal. So we root for one bad guy or the other because they're all sort of vaguely evil, unless they're just blatantly evil. And when one or the other character goes to the train station, that's code for getting bumped off, I believe. That's okay. We can live with that. Do you see how those values are seeping into our minds? Subtly, we are a nation getting hypnotized. We are a world getting hypnotized by evil because it's made to look so nice, so glamorous. Hey, it's Kevin Costner. It can't be that bad. Well, yes, it can. Yes, it can. And if you watch it over and over and over again, it's more than just entertainment. Be careful what you allow into your mind.
Does have a numbing effect.
It has a numbing effect. Everything the mind is incapable of distinguishing between fiction and reality. Mm-hmm. When you see something, the mind sees it as real, and it becomes a part of our experience. We have to be careful about what we let into our minds. We have to guard our hearts.
And there are facets, though, that we all relate to.
Oh, absolutely.
Of that. I mean, we've all encountered that, one form or another. Frequency will vary from person to person.
Yeah,
but nonetheless, So there is a level that we relate to it on, and almost as if, yeah, so.
Of course we do, yeah. Because we've been fed this stuff since the time we were children.
Right.
You know, it's in cartoons. It's look at these. I don't know what the cartoons are now, but the Looney Tune cartoons of days gone by. I mean, they were funny, and
they still are.
They still are funny. But look at, you know, poor what's a Wile E. Coyote getting clunked on with the anvil all the time by Roadrunner.
But it does teach a valuable lesson that two things, really. Number one, no matter how badly you want something, there are some things you simply cannot have.
Right.
And then the other thing, lesson I found from it is that life never gets so bad that it can't get worse.
That's very
cynical.
Would that be optimistic or pessimist? An optimist says, oh, pardon me, a pessimist says it can't get worse. An optimist says, "Yes, it can."
Okay.
So, but off the point. But one of the things, as we look at Mary here, Mary sets Jesus on the road to the cross. She also sets herself off on the road to the foot of the cross. Mm-hmm. You know, the cross is her moment of self-gift too. It's the moment that she lets go. Her son dies in a hideous, embarrassing, painful, torturous death before her eyes. He dies in agony for 3 hours. That's that rips a mother's heart apart, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. So when his time comes, her time comes. And her prayer of compassion at this wedding sets all of that in motion. Mm-hmm. So I hope everyone who goes to church this Sunday will reflect a bit on that story of the wedding at Cana in Galilee. Reflect on Mary's role. Reflect on what she gave by giving compassionately, and what she troubled. Another interesting thing to the story is what she worried about. She's worried about a party that might run out of wine and embarrass the husband and wife, the married couple. And so there's compassion there, but it's compassion about something that's joyful. I mean, running out of wine, the abundance of wine at these weddings, why is the wine there? The wine is there for joy and for fun. The wine has to last for a week or so. So it's not like they're guzzling it down in one fell swoop. This is a party that goes on and on and on. And it involves a lot of people, the whole village, whatever that would be. So Mary's concerned that the party keep going. And so there's an aspect in which we see that God is a God who supports and loves us when we are joyful. And so the first miracle of Jesus, the first in John, they're not called miracles, they're called signs. The first part of the Gospel of John is called the Book of Signs, and they're progressive wonders that reveal Jesus to be who he is, and this is the first one of them. The last is the raising of Lazarus from the dead. But in this, the first sign, Jesus shows messianic abundance, that God loves us to have the abundance of food and wine and all good things that God's provided. And Jesus is the one who gives. So sort of a great story. And what happens at the end of it? It leads to faith. It leads to belief. The disciples believed. Again, not sure what they believed or what the nature of their belief was, but their belief was progressive, as our faith is progressive. We're not born believers in Christ or believers in any type of religion. We discover it. We're given it. But when we come to faith, that faith is something that's progressive within us. It grows, and it should grow. And so we can ask the question: how are we doing? Not to sound too much like the late Mayor Koch.
Yeah.
So, but that's a good question to ask, a good spiritual question to ask. how am I doing? You know, am I progressing in my spiritual life? Am I on the way to my time, which has not yet come, but we need to be on the road. You know, Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me daily. And that's what we need to do every day. A commitment. We need to make a commitment. Lord, today I consciously pick up my cross.
And thank him in the process.
And thank him in the process, right. Because the cross, it leads to self-gift, but self-gift leads to life and joy. So this isn't a miserable process. This is a process that leads to God. And anything that leads to God leads to life. Anything that leads elsewhere leads to that which is not life, mm-hmm. commonly called
death.
So if we're following the way of the Duttons in Yellowstone, okay. or the way of the world, as it's revealed to us in the power politics of today. You know, we've got not a day goes by that my emails aren't email isn't cluttered with requests for money from this politician or that politician, because they want to separate me from my dough,
right?
And so that I can be part of the cause. And what's the cause? They're dividing us. Mm-hmm. They're dividing us over things that we ought not be divided over. They're dividing us racially. And you know, back in the day, if you were to ask any good Roman around the time of Christ, what's your race? He would say, the human race. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, there were different tones, but this racial division thing is rarely fairly new historically. Ultimately, there is one race, and that is human. We come in various shapes, colors, and sizes, but we're humans. We share that common human bond. We are brothers and sisters.
Regardless of skin color.
Regardless of skin color. Skin is skin deep,
it's
right?
It's superficial.
Everybody looks the same on the inside. And we're all given the same basic equipment. We all have, all people will vary, not based racially, but based in other. Some are smarter, some aren't as smart. So our ability to reason varies, but that can be coaxed and fixed. But basically, people are people, mm-hmm. and so let's recognize that and stop saying
celebrate it,
and stop saying all the problems in the world are caused because of our skin tone, or our vaccine status. That's another one that's killing me now. We need to just accept people and love them the way they come. I think we have a caller.
Yes, we do, Pastor. Good morning. You're on the air with Pastor Rich.
Good morning. I heard you mention about human race. Do you know that when I used to fill out applications and would say race, I mean, unless sometimes it's medical and they need to know medical reasons, I would put human.
good for you.
So anyway, it didn't matter, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't a medical thing, which they need to know.
Well, they don't. Why would any doctor need to know your race? I mean, I have no medical training, but
I'm not sure. But there might be certain things like sickle cell. I mean, I'm not sure, but I thought maybe on a medical thing I might answer it. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you know, job applications, everything else, I would just check other, and then I would write in human.
Yeah. You know? Well, good for you. I can't think of any reason that anyone would need to know our racial assignment in other than human. I mean, does it matter that I'm Chinese or I come from I'm from the India, the great subcontinent? India or Australia? I mean, it doesn't matter.
You know, I told my children, too, like, I think desensitize is the word I used with them and issues. And they said, what do you mean, Mom? I said, well, you know, if you walked in the house and your friend was hiding behind the door and they scared you, oh, after the second time, you'd again. But after that, you're not scared anymore.
Well, not only that, you probably... you'd probably answer the door harder, too. You'd open it a lot harder on the way in, expecting it.
Yeah.
True. Well, his friend would be hiding behind the door, but I said, if your friend wasn't there anymore, you would expect it. Or, you know, who cares? You just get desensitized to a lot of the issues. And,
well,
you know, I just, you know.
I agree with you. I think and it's easier now than any other time in history to desensitize people to the outrages that in other ages we would not accept. And over time, if you're told, oh, it's okay, everybody's doing it, don't worry about it.
No.
You know, one of the great examples of that is abortion. Back in the day that Roe versus Wade came down in 73. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, holy crow, people will never buy into this. Because at the time, I believe there was a very large consensus that abortion was not anything less than immoral and should be illegal because it's the taking of another human life,
mm-hmm.
which is what it is. I had a conversation years ago with a friend of mine who taught biology at St. Bonaventure University, Father Peter Schneibel, who is still teaching there, as a matter of fact. And he said to me, he said, Richard, you have to realize a fetus is not a kidney. You know, when you have a kidney, you can decide, I mean, that is my body. If I want my kidney,
removed,
I guess I can do that. Do you need a kidney? I don't know. Doesn't matter. But when you have a fetus, you have a second individual. God has breathed the breath of life into something else, and you are now a host organism. So, yes, it's your body, but you're a hosting, but you can't stop being the host without killing something else.
Right.
So I don't know any mother who has lost a child who says, oh, I was only a fetus.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But yeah. We have been desensitized into thinking it's a fetus. It's not really a human being. It's a fetus. And, hey, it's a constitutional right. Well, not everything that's a constitutional right is a good thing. That's why we have the ability to amend the Constitution. And we don't always do that wisely, but we at least have the ability to do it. But over time, we've been desensitized to that issue, so that now there's loads of people who think, well, yeah, it's only abortions, no big deal. It is a big deal, and every life that we lose to abortion is a life that God has breathed the breath of life into, and it's really an American Holocaust. So. And now it's not just abortion; it's late term abortion; it's partial birth abortion. It becomes more and more horrible.
It's anything goes today, and I think there's no more boundaries, no more, who cares? Who cares? Oh, well, that's my right. It's just, I hate to say it, technology has its place, but it's also, Will had said one time on this from WRCR. It's like a hammer. It can be constructive or destructive.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And that's how I feel technology is. Because I have my grandchildren, too, and they're getting back into board games, and I limit them. I said, I came to see Grandma. I don't want you to be on that iPad all the time. And we play a lot of music and singing and dancing, and they go out and they have good times. And it's got to be limited to it, And I think a lot of people with the technology... It's easier to be a bully. And
yes.
Leaving half of this stuff, there's no connection anymore. I hate to tell you, but I miss a lot of the stores when they've closed. I know it's, everybody's ordering online, but I have to go in a store sometimes and say, oh, you live here? Oh, yeah, I live there. Oh, you have a child a certain age? And you started up a conversation. Sometimes you made a friend.
Right.
Now, I don't know.
You're so onto something here because we're losing a sense of community by an imposed isolation.
Yes.
And the isolation is being imposed because of our fear of illness in this case. But the fear of illness, that the way they're approaching it makes our immune systems somewhat irrelevant. I mean, we can't not be exposed to stuff and expect ourselves to develop immunity to it.
Isolation taught us some things. Some people are cooking at home, being together with family, but that's only part of it. The rest of it is shutting us out from the world, from, like I said, communication. And I think that's where, you know, there's a lot more friction.
Yeah. Well, just look at the masks and the mask mandates and stuff like that. Masks are completely ineffective. I mean, they may make you feel good, but the meshing on the mask is larger than the virus. So a virus, the COVID virus, can go through these masks that we're wearing fairly easily. It's like trying to stop a mosquito with a chain link fence.
Well, but
we're also depriving ourselves of good oxygen, breathing back our bodily waste, our carbon dioxide, and making us more prone to things like viral pneumonia.
So don't doctors wear masks? And I personally think it's when I go in a store and places like that, I will put on the heavier mask. And, you know, if the kids have a cold, my grandchildren, sometimes I wear it. But
doctors wear masks against bacteria during operations. They usually don't wear them all around the hospital all day.
No.
They're not breathing in their carbon. I mean, depriving yourself of oxygen is depriving yourself of something your body needs. If you take those blood oxygen levels, they need to be, what, over 93, or you're in big trouble. So the mask is a mixed blessing. And I don't think it's much of a blessing at all. If somebody wants to wear one, hey, be my guest. But don't impose that on other people. I mean, wear your mask, protect yourself if you think that's helping you. But don't make kids wear them all day in school, for example. First of all, children are not likely to get that virus at all. Or if they do, it's not going to be serious. I mean, that's just statistically. But we're depriving them of their faces. Of human interaction, of it's go. Just there's too much. There's too much of a loss there.
There we go. That's what the call. And what is your name, Miss? I didn't catch it.
Oh, Marianne.
Marianne, thanks for calling. By the way, great call.
Well, Marianne, run. Have a good day.
You're running. Oh, thank you so much for calling.
Well, Marianne hit on earlier in the call.
Yeah.
Important point. How increasing reliance on technology increasingly removes the human element from life's daily interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, life becomes more impersonal. And as a result, the way we relate to one another suffers.
Well, and you can't, if you're a parent, you can't control as well what's coming into your child's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Subtly sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
If I've seen this happen a lot. And I understand why it happens. You know, Junior is kicking up a storm and wants to use the iPad or the iPhone and play games or do something like that. It's a great babysitter in some respects. It's fun. There's a lot of color there. It makes noises. Kids do love it. But you don't know what they're putting into their little minds when you give them your iPad. And they're connected to a world of evil, you know, and it's a cesspool out there, and we don't want to neglect our roles as guardians of the next generation.
Get them while they're young.
That's right, because the internet should not be raising our children, and the government should not be raising our children. We should be raising our children. Moms and dads, families, the smallest group of people you can call a church is a family. So Christian families out there, don't think of yourself as an address on Main Street or wherever you live. Think of yourself as a church, a church that gathers with other people of faith, other churches, other families on Sundays in a great larger faith community, also a family, not a building, but a family. And in that family, what do we learn? We learn that the most important thing in our life is our relationship with God. And I know you think, oh, he's got to say that. I mean, he's the pastor of a church, and for God's sakes. But it's true. It's true. And I would say this if I wasn't the pastor of the Clark Center Reformed Church or any other church. Because your relationship with God is ultimately the only thing that matters. And once you have it in place, it colors everything else. It colors the way you go to work. It colors what your career objectives might be. It colors how you interact with people casually in the neighborhood, in stores. It creates our last caller, Marion. She was saying, you know, we used to go in stores and people say, oh, yeah, you're somebody's grandma.
But you run into somebody, right. Doesn't your son go to such and such school? Or what? Yeah.
So those interactions are colored by faith. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? It means that unless there's a faith that and what's faith, right? Faith isn't just I believe in a bunch of stuff, because that's not, quite honestly, not faith. It's faith is a relationship, a living, vibrant relationship with God. And it has all the characteristics of any other relationship. So remember when you were falling in love for the first time, how you wanted to spend time with your beloved, how you wanted to talk with her or him, how you wanted to spend time together. How you wanted to go for walks and be a little bit more intimate, to hold hands. Well, that's what your relationship with God should and can be like. It's progressive, like any relationship, right? You meet the right person, the right guy, the right girl, and you begin to talk, and then the next day, maybe you sit together and have a picnic, or it grows and it grows. That's what faith should look like. Now, that most people who hear my voice right now are saying to themselves, what planet is he living on?
Do you think so?
I think in at least in terms of their lived experience.
Well, I'm listening to what you're saying. I mean,
I think most people think of prayer in the way that they thought of prayer as a child.
Okay.
Because it's like let me go to God and tell him what I want. It's almost like writing a list for Santa Claus, but you know Santa Claus is sort of better.
Which he does want to hear, but he wants to hear the thanks, though, for hearing the prayer and for the answer that he's already formulated.
Well,
we haven't even discerned yet.
Again, let me go back to Mary,
mm-hmm.
because Mary, when she prays in this passage from John's Gospel about Cana, mm-hmm. she doesn't say, "Jesus, make some wine for them, would you?" She says, "They have no wine." She lifts up a problem without giving him the answer. He provides the answer. He sees the stone jars. He says to the steward, fill them up with water. He says, take that to the chief steward and let him taste it. He solves the problem his way. And when we lift, you know, Lord, I want Susie to, I've fallen in love with Susie. Help her to understand that I love her. No, leave Susie alone. How about, Lord, I'm so lonely, help me. That's the prayer of Mary. Now, what do you give God? You give God the space, then, to answer the prayer in God's own way. Maybe Susie would drive you flipping nuts. Maybe Susie's a control freak. Maybe Susie and you like nothing in common. She only likes desserts and you only like sandwiches. I don't, whatever it is, you and Susie would not be a good match, but you are stuck on Susie. And but your prayer needs to be, Lord, I'm lonely, because that's why you're stuck on Susie. And then how does God answer that prayer? He answers it in his own way. Once you've prayed the prayer, by the way, then turn to the steward and say, do whatever he tells you to. But let me translate that into practice now. Lord, I'm lonely. Then start looking for God's answer. Watch. We do not see what we don't look for. We don't find what we're not looking for. And so if you ask God for help and then don't expect an answer, the answer might come and it'll go past you like a fastball that you don't even swing at, to use the mandatory sports metaphor.
We have a caller. Good morning. You're on the air with Pastor Rich.
Good morning, Pastor Rich. This is Bill Flynn.
Bill, how are you?
I'm fine. It's good to hear you on the radio, and good to hear you on Sundays, too.
Thank you very much.
And the way you're talking about when you ask God for help is that, you know, this has actually happened to me several times in my life. Actually, this is the third time that I actually was in a situation that I really needed God's help, and I resorted to prayer and asked God, would you step into my life? Would you imbibe me with the Holy Spirit to guide me? And it has led me to open up this square dancing thing that we're going to be opening in the church on Sunday, because the conversation about how we bring people together to share their lives and intermingle with each other as participants in the human race is that with this square dancing, it's friendship set to music.
Oh, I like that. That's good.
Yeah, and it's you know, you meet up with people, you learn how to dance, but now when you're dancing, in between the dances, when you sit down to take a little break from the dance, you sit down, hello, and these are people that you would not have met had you not come to this dance. And how can we get people to come together is like, you have to ask them, say, would you come and say hello with us, and would you learn this here, because it's something that's fun, and it's something exercise. You get out to meet people and intermingle. Otherwise, you sit at home and watch the TV or a movie or, you know, whatever it is, but you're not really intermingling. And as you said, our church is the people. It's not actually the building, but the people. And with what I propose here, God put this in my lap to say, go bring this to the church and bring more people to the church.
Thanks, Bill. And keep in mind that dance is, in some ways, friendship set to music. We've got a number of dance events in addition to square dancing, which I think, Bill, we're starting next Sunday, right?
Yes.
In addition to that, we're having a number of dinner dances there, too. So why dance? Dance because when you dance, in a certain sense, you lose yourself into the presence of another. And that's why there's a hymn called The Lord of the Dance, right, where Jesus is the Lord of the dance, and he's the one who leads, and we follow. And so with square dancing, with ballroom dancing, with any type of dancing, we learn something with tremendous spiritual benefit and or value, and that's to let go of ourselves. One of the things that kept me from dancing for years is my self-consciousness, you know, because I've never danced well I never thought I did, and if I have this neurotic belief that everybody is watching me,
right,
when I go out on the dance floor. So as a consequence, I glue myself into a seat and try to hide from anyone who would ask me to dance, and think of a reason to say no if she did. But you know, to overcome that is to let go of my ego. You know, does it matter what I look like? If somebody wants to dance with me, if I want to dance with them, why should I care what other people think? Just like if I want to engage in a relationship with Christ, we need to let Christ lead. And why should we care what anybody thinks? If the world doesn't approve of our Christian values, the heck with them. We don't care. I don't care. Let them think we're old-fashioned. Let them think we're neurotically clinging to our Bibles. Let them think whatever they think, because we have something of tremendous value. We have a relationship with God, and that relationship must lead us to action. We can't just sit around. It's like holding hands with your beloved. Mm-hmm. You do more than that. You people in love make signs of love. You know, they send flowers, they give gifts. And how do we send flowers to God? We do that by living a life worthy of our relationship with Him, worthy of our calling. And what does that mean? It means not buying into the nonsense, the utter nonsense that the world is dishing out as wisdom. Because materialism and power... Power bought at the price of the lives and well-being of others often, that it's not worth it. Pleasure isn't worth it. Possessions aren't worth it. Nothing is worth the loss of our integrity. And our integrity can only be found in that relationship that we must have with God. And we find it, as Christians, we find it in Christ, the human being who shows us the potential of our own humanity to shine forth with the light of the Father. That's what Jesus did, and that's what He shows us we can do. And that alone is of value. But when we set our minds on it, when we set that course, and we know that we'll slip and fall and we'll not always do it terrifically, but when we do that, we are on the path to life and to happiness and to joy. So let me give you homework, because if you are a Christian, I think some of the questions that are worth asking is, where am I as a Christian? You know, where am I on my walk? How far have I advanced? Do I love God more now than earlier in my life? Have I matured in faith since I started on my path? Only you can honestly answer those questions. I would suggest that those questions might be the beginning of a faith journal that will be... a way that you can chronicle your walk with the Lord. So thank you so much for being with us this week. Vince, thank you for being my sidekick,
Pastor.
Here.
Not at all. Always a pleasure. Please remember to tune in next Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock on WRCR 1700 AM, and also come on to the Clarkstown Reformed Church.
And next week we'll have as our special guest Rabbi Ben Zion Klotzko.
Look forward to it.
Amen.